Over the last 800 years in this country, generation after generation of working class people have thrown themselves into struggles and campaigns to improve their lives and livelihoods, address injustices, and secure what we would come to describe as basic civil liberties and human rights. I'm interested in learning more about this fascinating story of working class struggle over the centuries of British history. So over a series of podcasts, I'm bringing together a number of expert historians to discuss just some of the key periods of struggle by working people in our history. The first period I've selected is the period from the 14th century late medieval period to the 16th century into the Tudor reign. This period encompasses some of the famous, or to some, notorious struggles from what was known as the Peasants' Revolt in 1381, Jack Cade's Revolt of 1450, through the Pilgrimage of Grace in 1536, to Kett's Rebellion of 1549, and the Commotion Time. I want to explore what society was like for working people throughout this period. What were the causes of the revolts, and what were the lasting outcomes for our society? To discuss this, I'm so pleased to be joined by Martin Empson. Martin Empson is an author and activist living in Manchester. His book, Kill All the Gentlemen, is a history of class struggle and change in the English countryside. Also, Ted Valance. Edward Valance is professor of early modern British political culture at the University of Roehampton. His books include A Radical History of Britain, Visionaries, Rebels and Revolutionaries, The Men and Women Who Fought for Our Freedom. Also, Justin Fernharbour Baker. Justin Fernharbour Baker is senior lecturer in medieval history at the University of St Andrews, and she recently edited the Routledge History Handbook of Medieval Revolt. Ted, can I start with you? Give us a brief description of the Peasants' Revolt, the key events, what happened, who was involved, and what was the outcome. I'll come on to the issues about the lasting implications. Just give us a rundown of actually what happened. Because what is interesting, when I've raised this in discussions, actually I've quoted from your book, it's interesting you get quite a few blank faces about, oh, I never knew what happened. And also, interesting in all of this as well is when I've been doing meetings, some of the most fascinating responses I've had is when you point out the localities of what happened and the proximity to some of the of these events to local communities as well.
Yeah, well, I'm going to preface my comments by saying that, you know, as you've noted in my radical history book, one of the perils really of doing a very broad sweep history like that is the danger of being, a jack of all trades, a master of none. So I preface this by saying I'm a 17th century historian by training. So I'm coming in really into the latter end of the period we're talking about. But the initial trigger is the imposition of this poll tax, which is first imposed in 1377. And it's actually the third iteration of this tax, which really triggers a revolt, the first revolts in Essex against the collection of the tax. And the main reason why the third collection prompts the actual revolt is because they're starting to crack down on tax evaders. The similarities with poll tax in 1990, and that a lot of people were sort of, you know, trying to get off, you know, the equivalent of electoral rolls in the 14th century. And Edward VII's government was cracking down on that. But it quickly moves from this kind of localized revolt into something which is a revolt against the national architects of this policy. So the awareness of the broader political context is important. They are quickly targeting people like Archbishop Sudbury and Sir Robert Hales, who are seen as being the main, you know, initiators and drivers forward of this poll tax policy. So June of 1381, moving risings in Kent as well as in Essex. It's in Kent that we first really hear about Wat Tyler becoming the kind of leader of this rebellion. It's Tyler who frees, along with the other Kentish rebels, frees John Ball from Maidstone prison. Ball had already been in a lot of trouble with the ecclesiastical authorities at the time as a result of some of the radical preaching that you're talking about. And the rebels, I think this is one of the characteristics of 1381 and 1450, is because these are rebellions that see issues with royal government and with members of the court, those who are advising the king. It's directed towards London and towards, if you like, you know, taking action against those royal ministers. So the rebel host sort of gather supporters, moves towards London. And, you know, by the middle of June, the rebels have really, you know, in many ways taken control of the city. They've laid waste to sort of large chunks of Southwark. They've demolished pretty much John of Gaunt's magnificent palace in Savoy. You know, they've thrown lots of his treasured possessions into the river and so forth. They've, you know, taken various royal officials and executed kind of rough justice against them. And so we get to the point where, you know, we've got this really kind of climactic moment where this boy king, because we have to remember that the initiator of the poll tax, Edward III, has died. He's replaced with his grandson, Richard II. So we've got a boy king, Richard II, who on 14th June goes out and basically concedes. He basically concedes, that there will be kind of freeing of serfs from the counties that have come in revolt to London. And that has the effect of leading a lot of this rebel host to basically dissipate. But the group that doesn't dissipate is actually the Kentish rebels with Wat Tyler at their head. And this is where we get that sort of, you know, I refer to it in the book as a kind of JFK's assassination moment. Wat Tyler's death, was it something that Tyler brought on himself when he goes to meet Richard II? Is it something where it's pre-planned? And, you know, his killing by the Lord Mayor of London is in fact actually something that was an organized assassination attempt. Whatever, you know, the nature of that event, that does sort of break the revolt within London, although revolts continue around the rest of the country. So it isn't just sort of a cutting off the head and that's the end of it. And, you know, what we see is quite swiftly after the revocation by Richard of those grants of manumission and, you know, some fairly kind of severe reprisals in the areas where the rebellion was most prevalent. And that's my potted history. Anyway, I hope others will come in to correct things that I've forgotten.
Martin, the issue for me is that they won. The scale of the revolt was such that the king, the establishment, whatever you want to call it, had to concede, but then it fell apart.
There's an amazing moment in the Peasants' Revolt when the king and his closest advisors are shored up in the Tower of London discussing what to do. And one faction of the court are all for riding out and killing as many of the peasants as they can get away with and possibly facing a military defeat, but seeing it as a glorious defeat. And the others, the faction that wins out, and I think for the English royal family, possibly very, very luckily, is those that say to the young Richard II, he's only 14, what you should do is grant them their reforms, grant them what they want, and then we'll take it back off them in the future. And it's possibly the first time it happens. It's not the first time that this has been said to a group of workers or labourers, you know, yes, we'll give you that, of course, you know, you're all on strike, go back to work and we'll talk about it next week type thing. And that leads to one of the most incredible series of meetings where Richard II meets with the assembled masses and basically grants them everything they want, the end of serfdom. And not just those big things. Many of the peasants come with very little demands, incredibly localized, about the use of a bridge or tolls, about how to grind corn in their local villages. And he has an army of people who draft documents to say, I've granted them. And one of the things that undermines the revolt is that these people then return to their villages, reducing the numbers in London, reducing the threat to the capital. But also have the effect of spreading it, because they say, look, we've come back from London and we've been granted this charter by the king. Well, and so other people say, well, maybe we can do the same. But the host in London, as it were, the mass of people is numerically depleted and undermined. And as Ted said earlier, it helps to reinforce in people's ideas that Richard is on their side, and that he will look after them Once that has happened, he then meets again, and there's this confrontation where Wat Tyler dies, possibly orchestrated, possibly a lucky accident. But in the moment where Tyler is killed, the descriptions are that the assembled rebels bend their bows, and in that moment, really, you could have seen the loss of the of a whole section of the English lords and royal families, and Richard writes to them and says, "I'm your king. I won't let this happen. Trust me. Disperse. We'll sort it all out. Really sorry." And it undermines the rebellion. He uses his personal authority with the rebels to undermine things. And then when they do disperse, the bloodletting continues, and Richard leads a force through Kent and Essex that brutally puts down. Walsingham says gibbets were raised where none had been seen before. They hang and murder people through Kent and Essex to re-establish their authority.
Take us on to the Cades revolt.
One of the interesting things, there's a paraphrase, I think, about of something Richard II is supposed to have said to some petitioners after the peasants' revolt was finished, where they approach him and say, "What about our charters you grant?" And he's supposed to have said, "You'll always be serfs, you wear serfs and you always will be, and how dare you look at me like this?" And in one sense, they defeat the peasants' revolt, but because they cannot get rid of the underlying oppression and exploitation in society, it's on barely 70 years before another revolt explodes, again in Kent, led by Jack Cade, who we don't really know much about, possibly a former soldier from the Hundred Years' War. And the revolt is, again, about economic injustices, in particular the costs and taxation, but also the way Henry VI has basically used his wealth to encourage a whole network of people, friends and family, to rule Kent in particular as they want. And this very direct, heavy extra exploitation and oppression creates the basis for a big, angry rebellion. Again, the trigger is also, as Justine said right at the start, a high level of awareness of what's going on. They blame the king for the failures in France, the defeats in the war there, again, raids on the coastline and so on. And so, as you said earlier, John, they march on London, both with the intention of rebelling, but also of demanding change, asking the king to change things. A larger host, not quite as large, I don't think, as the one that was in the Peasants' Revolt, but they assemble again on Blackheath, and the king flees to the Midlands, and they enter London. They riot. It's actually much, much more undisciplined than the Peasants' Revolt. There's a lot of pillaging, assault, violence, murder, robbery. And a series of confrontations take place, including a pitched battle between some of the king's key lords, the Staffords, who were defeated by Jack Cade's army, which causes a crisis at the top around the king's advisors, who some of whom want to give in to the demands undermining, but in the end they managed to gather enough forces to challenge Cade's army in Kent. They follow him around, breaking up and defeating him, and eventually he's isolated and captured and killed very publicly for leading the revolt.
Interesting, the brutality of the regime, repression that took place, and the way in which they treated what they identified as the leaders of these revolts, to make them examples, to make sure others didn't rise up again. But they keep rising up. Justin, the next one is Kett's. Well, it's the Pilgrimage of Grace, isn't it? And then it's Kett's rebellion that then takes place in Norwich. Take us through that if you can.
Okay. I mean, I'm probably the least qualified to talk about Kett's rebellion.
We'll all come in on it.
Kett's seems to sort of start over the issue of enclosure and enclosing what were common lands that anyone could use for individual use. And Ket himself, I mean, the first thing they'd tear down is Ket's own enclosure. But he joins them and then becomes the leader of this rebellion, tearing down other enclosures. And again, there's this sort of almost following literally in the footsteps of the 1381 rebels. They camp at Mousehold, where 1381 had camped. And then they make that a really armed camp. And this is one of the things that I think we have to remember with all of these revolts is that they're very militarized. And that is because the population of England is very militarized. So we might think about medieval, early modern, you know, we have this idea of knights in shining armor. But from the 14th century onward, armies are about infantry and archers. So those are people from the villages. And quite often the leadership of these revolts, and indeed the foot soldiers are people who have been in royal armies. And like actually in Cade's revolt, to a lesser extent in 1381, but you can see this too, there is a pitched battle and that is the way that the revolt is put down in August. So you have very material causes, very economic causes in Ket's rebellion. But I think also there you have ideas about community and commons that are, sorry to pun, but common to all of these revolts. It's very much about who are the commons, but also what are the commons, what are our common resources, and what do we have in common?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think Martin touched on this earlier, that particularly in the 1549 rebellions, you see this sort of joining together of popular ideas of the commons with this elite ideology of the Commonwealth that is a feature of some of the people around the circle of Edward VI's government. So you've got this kind of fusing of sort of some of the kind of social reforming ideas of evangelical Protestantism with an idea of, you know, the commons at a popular level and with almost with popular self-government, because, you know, it's slightly romanticized, but we do have these, you know, these accounts of Ket with his Oak of Reformation dispensing justice. You know,
explain that. I was born in Liverpool, but I was brought up just outside Great Yarmouth. So Ket and Norwich, Ket is seen still as a local hero. The number of places that are named after him is staggering. But explain that, because the Oak of Reformation is part and parcel of that story. It sort of stands as a symbol of what people thought he was all about.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a feature of, I think, the other revolts in particular, and perhaps particularly 1381, that it's actually not, you know, contrary to what medieval and early modern chroniclers would say of sort of revolts being about anarchy and the unleashing of kind of elemental forces. A lot of the time, the rebels are trying to enact what they see as being proper justice, that justice has basically been taken over by rapacious lords, by bad lords, and they want to kind of enact you know, proper justice for the common good, for the common weal. And in Ket's rebellion, this is sort of, we get this really sort of powerful image of that, with Ket effectively there as sort of the dispenser of good justice under this Oak of Reformation, you know, dispensing, you know, proper justice to the good people of Norfolk and Norwich. And so instead of it, this camp being this sort of, as you know, hostile chroniclers like Neville and Southerton would say, sort of a, you know, a site of all sorts of bestial depravity, in fact, it's a site of good government, of order, of the dispensing of real justice. I'd like to come back, if I can, quickly to that point about the military nature of these rebellions. I think it's really important because, and it's actually something that recent research is really showing us more about. There's a project called The People of 1381, which I would really recommend actually people listening to this podcast go and check out their website. There's increasing evidence that military veterans of the Hundred Years' War are important figures in the Peasants' Revolt and in Cade's Rebellion. And again, actually, when we look at Kett's Rebellion, that final clash between the rebel host and between the forces of the Earl of Warwick, the more recent research suggests that it's much less of a rout than we previously thought, that in fact, actually, the rebels take out quite a lot of that royal army, and it's a pretty close run thing between them in actually, the force of the Earl of Warwick coming out victorious. So I think it's really important people understand that these are not sort of just peasants, armed, who are not kind of militarily experienced, who are poorly armed. These are sort of, two seriously armed camps coming into contact with each other.
And interesting enough, the Royal Army is also largely mercenaries as well, which is, again, it's quite remarkable how, just reading up from your own chapter onto Martin's and others, and actually, to give Sansom his due in his Shard Lake series, he's written the novel Tombland, which I think is a very good read, just to give it a plug. But the emphasis upon the fact that the Royal Army is mercenaries, and I think it does reinforce the local appraisal of Kett and what happened then as something being a justified rebellion of local people, but then, savagely repressed again. They hung Kett from the castle walls, didn't they? And his brother was hung from the church in Wyndham as well.
Yes, and his bones reputedly were still visible in the early 17th century from the walls of them.
If I could come in on 1549, because I agree very much with Justin and Ted, but I think one of the interesting things that we see with Kett's Rebellion is the way that Kett's Rebellion was bigged up by the establishment and the aftermath, because one of the things they were very wary of doing was admitting the fact that the whole country was in revolt. And one of the things that I think has been interesting about recent research into the period is the uncovering of a much wider uprising across the whole of the country. Now, we've focused on Kett's Rebellion, but just before Kett's Rebellion, there was a very important rising in Cornwall called the Western Rising, which is usually known as the Prayerbook Rising because it was initiated, sparked by the introduction of the new prayer book, and particularly a problem in Cornwall because they were insisting that people couldn't hear the mass in Latin but had to hear it in English, which of course they didn't speak either, but was seen as a almost colonial imposition of conditions. And that was very, very violent and again very brutally put down by the mercenary forces. In fact, one of the reasons I think Kett's Rebellion went on so long is because they were so worried and busy in the West. But there were also dozens and dozens, we call it here the commotion time, but it was also at the time known as the camping time, because there were dozens and dozens of these camps set up.
Just to explain that tactic that they used, it started with the Peasants' Revolt, didn't it, where they camped outside of London, but that tactic then became a consistent pattern used throughout.
Well, we know very little about the wider camps in 1549. I think we can speculate that they were attempts to show strength through numbers and an organisation feature. Certainly we know that in the Kett's Rebellion, there were a number of camps around East Anglia where groups of people came together and messaged between the different camps to make plans and so on. I think in Kett's Rebellion in particular, the camp was very much seen, as Ted has said, through the Oak of Reformation, as a symbol of a mirroring, if you like, of the existing state. Kett set himself up almost as a king, though I think it's sometimes used as a slur against him. He wasn't really intending it that, but they had a system of judges, they had a system of law, they had a system of mass participatory democracy. And I think it was seen as both an example of how things could be different, but also to contrast deliberately what was happening in Norwich, where, of course, it was incredibly hierarchical, and London and and so on. So I think it's, and I think we see this today. I think sometimes some of the climate camps or the Extinction Rebellion protests, I think they're often protesters and activists see them as a way of organizing to demonstrate that things can be done differently. You know, we can all live together nicely and share food and collectively organize and protect ourselves and so on. And I think that's very much something that happened today. Whether it was the right tactic at the time to defeat Somerset and the King is, of course, a different question. But I think it's, as you said, a bit of a thread through rebellions of the period.
I relate it to my own experience, and this is anecdotal. Climate Camp was in my constituency because it was a campaign against the Third Runway. And 1,000 people turn up overnight and set up a camp. But what the Climate Camp did, this is most probably reflects what it did in the other camps over these periods of revolts. It became, for our local community, a place where the discussion went beyond NIMBYism into something much broader. So I could envisage on Mousefield Heath, actually, when people camped, they did have discussion about the nature of society, and it did. You learn things from it. In Climate Camp in my constituency, Gaines Heathrow, Harmersworth, the ladies from Harmersworth joined in. So these wonderful women in their blue rinses sitting in circles on straw bales talking about no longer just the Third Runway in the context of losing their homes, but in the context of climate change. I could envisage in those camps in the 15th and 16th century, there's just political discussions going along around those campfires. And then I agree with you, the discussion about how they organized them very much prefigured the sort of society that they wanted to create as well. Just to say also, it didn't just end with Kett and the Cornwall one I found was fascinating. I didn't fully appreciate before how actually there was a complete distinguished language that was taking place. And so the imposition of the prayer book must have been absolutely infuriating. You lose Latin, which you may not have fully understood, but you're emotionally associated with. Then they impose English, which you don't speak anyway. I can see how that could have really tipped people over the edge. But the afforestation's issues then went on, didn't they, into the 16th century, earliest period of 17th century as well, up until the Civil War, where the royal forests were then being allocated. Some people compensated for the loss of that commons, but others not as well, Ted.
Yeah, I mean, the issue of enclosure remains one that continues to be, a touch point for revolt into the early 17th century and mid-17th century. John Lilburn, the Leveller leader, gets involved in sort of anti-enclosure legal actions as well in the mid-17th century. So what people I think should understand about enclosure as well is that it is a case of really taking away resources from the community. So if we think about common land, we might think about it just in terms of the commons that we see today, you know, flat fields, bits of grass. But if you're talking actually specifically about East Anglia, you're talking about things like fen commons as well as, you know, dry land commons. And in the fen common, people have access to that land. They've got a whole set of resources they can exploit. They've got reed beds, you know, for thatching. They've got, you know, animals, they've got fish, and they've got wildfowl that they can catch to eat. There's a whole set of resources that are basically being taken away from them when you enclose that land. And I guess, you know, this is to really go into the 17th century, there's a really interesting thing here with the digger movement and, Gerard Winstanley and the movement to do something very radical with common land to create a communal settlement. And that really illustrates, I think, some of the very great complexities around commons and common land, in that some of those who locally oppose the digger movement are themselves, you know, people of the same, if you like, social stratum as the diggers. And one of the reasons why they're opposed to those settlements is because putting a communal settlement on St. George's Hill restricts the common rights of other people, because you're taking away grazing land from your neighbours. So there's all these sort of, you know, very complex and interesting issues, I think, being explored and contested around, you know, what is the commons? What are common rights? What does the community have kind of collective right to?
What does society look like in this period?
What society is like in this period is it's mainly agrarian society. It's a very unequal society. It's a society in which the majority of the population work the land. They owe service to a lord. So they're not typically at the beginning of the period free labourers. They're not straightforwardly wage labourers or tenant farmers. That changes towards the end of the period that we're talking about. And it's a society that is supposedly structured around three orders, around the nobility, the clergy, and the peasantry. And it's not, as I say, it's a very unequal society. Things change over the course of the period that we're talking about. We might, to put it crudely, say that towards the end of the period that we're looking at here, towards the period of the commotion time, we might see something more like what we might recognize as middle class being there. But there's less of that kind of gradation, say, in the earlier period that we're talking about. So it is a society in which a lot of people are literally unfree. Although I think one of the interesting things about the revolts that we're talking about here is that they are not, in fact, purely revolts of peasants, revolts of serfs. They are revolts in which many of those who are involved, indeed, in leadership roles within these rebellions are actually not peasants. They are people who are free in a legal sense. They are people who have roles within local government. So they're not, as it were, outside necessarily of the state as we might conceive of it at this time. And so that suggests something as well about the nature of what's being contested in these rebellions, that it is not just about necessarily breaking free from serfdom, from feudalism, that there are broader conceptions of freedom that are being played around with here and being argued for.
Martin, let me bring you in. In your book, you're looking at the evolution of that society and the economy from that agrarian economy under feudalism, then the emergence, gradual emergence of early capitalism. Explain that.
So I think Ted makes some very important points, that what we see over this period is not one consistent way to understand society. And it's quite easy to look back on the past and impose how we understand society on the past and look for similarities when actually things were very different. But from really the 14th century to the 16th century, what you see is the gradual change of the economies at the base of society, about how food is produced and why food is produced and who it's sold to and the networks of exchange and trade that take place. And this is interesting because what it means is that you get a struggle in the countryside on two levels, one of which is for people to try and improve their lives, protect their conditions, stop exploitation or oppression in one form or the other. But also you get people resisting the changes that are taking place to their lives, which often they have very little control over. I think this is particularly apparent as we head towards the revolts of the mid-16th century and on into the English Civil War. But even early on, you have a class of interest because society is such a, as Ted said, a class-ridden society. The interests of the people at the top very rarely coincide with those at the bottom. So that even then, there are tendencies for the people at the top of society trying to do things for the people at the bottom to improve their lot, and hence the risk resistance that develops. I think that begins very emphatically with the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. But as the period we're discussing today continues, you see more and more of that through to Kett's Rebellion, which I think is very interesting because it begins with the question of enclosure, the forced transformation of people's land, and ends really with people raising questions about how their society should be organised, how democracy should work, and so on.
Just on Ted's point, though, we'll come on to what the triggers were for these revolts, the underlying causes. But on Ted's point, though, the peasants' revolt is a misnomer, isn't it, in terms of the participants in that? Because a lot of them weren't what you describe as peasants. A lot of them were those involved in a whole range of different trades. They were not completely dependent, as you'd expect, on agriculture. They'd be part of the, I was looking at the list, I think, in your book, of the people who'd participated, particularly those who were, tragically, those ones who were, well, the state acted against, who were hung, imprisoned, etc. A lot of them were people with who were actually dependent on trade rather than on agriculture itself.
Yes, and again, I think here we have to be careful of projecting our understanding of society back onto the past, because I think, for instance, Wat Tyler, the famous leader of the Peasants' Revolt, clearly by his name was probably a tiler, not someone who necessarily worked in the fields. But he would have seen himself as coming from a peasant community, though he probably would not have articulated it like that. And the vast bulk, I mean, at the height of the Peasant Revolt, perhaps 30, 50,000 people marched and protested and demonstrated and rioted in London. And the bulk of those would have people have been who would have worked the land and come from communities that did. On the other hand, there were also overlaps. If you were a blacksmith in the village in Kent, you may well have had a few acres or a bit of patch of land to grow food and look after. So your identification with the people around you would have been much, much tighter than, say, I think as Ted said, with later on, where a more middle class yeomanry appear who would have had more of an allegiance to people above them as instead of those below. So I do think these distinctions matter, but I think understanding them more as a result of a revolt of the people at the bottom of society is perhaps a better way of understanding the dynamic.
Justin, across Europe, this has appeared in feudalism had dominated. It was one in which the bulk of the population were living in rural communities, not in towns as such. But in your work, across Europe, this was happening right the way across Europe, where feudalism was being challenged in this way.
Yeah, I mean, we tend not so much to talk about feudalism anymore, but about lordship and about relationships of domination. Quite often, though, it's not so much the local lord who is the problem, though that was the case in many communities during the Peasants' Revolt, which, as Martin is sort of indicating, they were tend more often now to call the English Rising. But people are very aware of national and royal politics. And I think that that really speaks to the extent to which even village communities are very politicized in the 14th century. You know, we really shouldn't think of illiterate peasants in huts. These are people who are tied into commercial networks, who are, they're sort of literally listening to the news. A lot of them are literate. They move around a lot. And particularly in the context of a post-Black Death world, which is maybe something we want to talk about too, and one in which there is a lot of warfare, people are very much interested in current events and feeling that they have a role to play in influencing those events.
Just explain the post-Black Death period and the implications of that.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, we are now living in a society that's going through a pandemic. So I think we have a little bit more of an understanding what these people might have been going through and the kind of dislocations it might have caused for them psychologically, if nothing else. So the Black Death, which hits England in 1348 for the first time, kills about 50% of the population, right? So we're dealing with a mortality rate of sort of 1% to 3% right now. So we can imagine how much worse that was. And the Black Death doesn't really go away. It keeps coming back. There's another big outbreak in 1361 and 1378, but it really kind of becomes endemic. So that kind of demographic collapse really leads to a reordering of society and some conservative efforts, particularly on the part of the powerful, to maintain the status quo ante. So for example, promulgating labor legislation that fixes wages at pre-plague levels. But obviously, when you have that kind of, you know, you have a lack of laboring bodies, so you need to pay them more. It also has really important taxation implications because it halves the tax base. But at the same time, as I was referring to with the increase in warfare, it's not getting any cheaper to wage war. So you have a lot more taxation pressures, and particularly on working class people, because the elite in society, as we know, tend to be tax exempt in various ways. And that happened in the Middle Ages as well as...
Nothing changes, does it really?
No. Yeah, tout ça change. So there's a sense in which there are more opportunities for working class people, which is most people, and also a sense in which they really feel that the game is rigged against them, and they are right about that. It is rigged against them. And also in a society that is becoming more literate, there is a lot that enables people to revolt as well as sort of forces them to revolt.
What was the trigger for the peasants' revolt?
Well, the immediate trigger is taxation, the imposition of a poll tax to pay for war with France and other urgent needs at the top of society.
See, nothing really does change, did it? I went through the poll tax campaign, yes.
But of course, tax imposition doesn't always trigger mass revolt. And I think this is where understanding the dynamics at the bottom of society, both the changes taking place, but the endless exploitation, oppression, and so on that is going on. So when the tax collectors ride into Brampton in Essex, there's an immediate response by the local community refusing to pay. They drive the collectors out. But as Justine, I think, really importantly makes the point, they then don't leave it at that. What they do is they contact their friends and family in other communities and other villages, and the revolt spreads, quite literally like wildfire, across Essex and then into Kent. And I think Justine's point about politicized communities is very important, because the ruling class then portrayed, and I think still today, we're taught that these villagers were ignorant, they didn't know what they did, they came to London and burnt things indiscriminately. Actually, they were incredibly disciplined about how they understood the world, and they were politicized by the events that they experienced, but also the ones around them. And the Hundred Years' War, I think, is particularly important. You know, people experienced the war, if they weren't fighting, as raids on their territory, as things that were impacting on their lives, their communities and their villages, and they wanted something done about it. So the revolt is not just a revolt against the people at the top of society. It's also a demand on the king to do something about the situation they find themselves in. And this is, in fact, one of the things that undermines the revolt, because their illusions in the king at the top of society helping them enables him to undermine the rebellion at the end.
We'll come on to the specific actions, but just taking up this point, Ted, what I found remarkable all the way through each one of these individual uprisings, virtually all of them pose it in a way in which they are loyal to the king, and his misguided advisors or courtiers that are causing the problem. But their ideological base is actually maintaining that structure of royal power. It's remarkable. The kings always seem to get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I think this is a fascinating aspect of these revolts. And it's something that you can look at as sort of, this is naive monarchism. This is, you know, that these rebels go to London. You know, Richard II tells them, you know, that they're going to be free. They all go away. And that's, you know, they then get their comeuppance later on. And the same thing happens under Cage Rebellion. And Kett's rebels also seem to think that they're, you know, working for Edward VI's government in certain ways. I think, though, casting it as just naivety is a misunderstanding. And I allude back to that really important point that Justine made about the understanding and awareness of national politics. And I think it's that they understand that they're trying to work within a political system. They're trying to use various levers that there are within the current political system. And one of those, actually, which I think is a thread all the way through, is petitioning. There are, I think, some ways in which you can see these revolts as a kind of petitioning with menaces. It's you know, you're going to the top, you're putting forward your demands, and you're couching it in this legitimate, you know, form of the petition. But obviously, you've got thousands of people in arms, you know, behind you to try and back this up. So I think that's, you know, it's strategic. I think I wouldn't characterize it as naive. And I think ultimately the other thing is that, you know, when a king like Richard II issues a pardon, I mean, that's almost as good as it gets, unless you want to actually take that next intellectual step. And it's not clear to me, you know, who has taken that next intellectual step in the late medieval period. And as I say, I'm somebody who works on the mid 17th century normally. It's not even that easy once you do take that step. You know, if you cut off the king's head in 1649, it doesn't solve all of your problems. You are left with all of these issues of legitimacy that you have to grapple with, and you have to then sort of work out. So I think it's sort of, it's a really, really interesting aspect of these revolts, the relationship with the monarchy. It's also one that doesn't go away. It's something that you can trace through later English working class movements. I mean, you can look at the Chartists. The Chartists would often petition the crown. They saw it as a way of, you know, getting around the sort of corrupt political class and approaching the monarchy, which was somehow, you know, going to resolve these issues that the Chartists were calling for. Again, you might see it as being naive, but it's also strategic. It's also about presenting yourself as working within a system, as you say, being loyal, which seems bizarre, you know, given that you're taking up arms. I don't think it's, you know, it's actually quite a complex move that's being made here.
How do you account for this loyalty to the king, but virulent denunciations of the church?
Well, I think that's because of, you know, we have to distinguish the church from religion. Religion is actually an important ideological source for these rebellions, and certainly this is the case in the 17th century. I mean, John Ball is the, you know, the ideologue of the Peasants' Revolt. Lollardy, probably important in Kaye's Revolt. And the ideas of the Edwardian Reformation, important to Kett's rebels. But the church itself is part of this structure of power and control of resources. And so that's why, you know, key reason why there's a lot of antagonism towards it. But there's also a lot of ideological material, you know, which is very powerful in Christianity, which can be a source for revolt. And so, you know, John Ball's, you know, when Adam delved and Eve Span, who was then the gentleman. I mean, this is the, you know, the core text, if you like, of medieval revolt. So it's a complex relationship, I think. And it's one where different strands of Christianity at different points, it's that whole thing of, you know, trying to control you know, the ideological potential of Christianity and its potential actually to raise questions about social order, and to raise questions about the distribution of wealth, which is a thing that Christianity continues to do, you know.
Justin, this is reflected across Europe.
Yeah, very much. You know, I was really interested in Kett's revolt. You know, one of their articles is that every man should be free because Christ made us all free with his blood shedding. That's something you find throughout revolts in Europe, this idea that freedom, which often means freedom from serfdom, but can actually be freedom from taxation. I have seen it used in that way, is something that that all Christians get because of because of Christ's crucifixion. And, you know, there is a way in which that is a very progressive idea, because we all are of one quality because of Christianity. But that is also exclusionary, in that the people who are free and the people who are truly human are Christian. And actually, in a context like late medieval Catalonia in Spain, the contrast really is between Christians who are free and fully human, and everybody else, particularly Jews and Muslims, who are not fully human. And so along with what we now might call political popular revolts, we also in the late Middle Ages and in the early modern period see popular violence against religious minorities. So, you know, it does cut both ways, but I absolutely agree with Ted, and I'm sure Martin thinks this, that, you know, there's this radical equality strain in Christianity. Galatians 3:28, there is neither Jew nor Gentile, man nor woman, slave nor free, for all are one in Christ Jesus. That's very much part of medieval Christianity and very much part of the ideology of revolt.
Yeah. Martin, in your book, when you've dealt with up to Age of Commotion, you've then got that chapter which is talking about the transition from feudalism to capitalism. And there you link the rise of Protestantism with the rise of the increasingly merchant class. How does that relate to this?
I think we have to be careful we're not too crude and don't suggest that there were a whole group of new capitalists who developed who converted to Protestantism. I think what happens in society through this period and reaches its culmination, and I think Ted will know more about this, but reaches its culmination in the sort of English Civil War, is tensions at the base of society, inside the economic organisation of society, that are reflected ideologically. There are people who don't like the way that the old Catholic Church is organising things, the paying of tithes, the indulgences that are being bought and sold, and so on. And there are a new group of people developing who are more interested in organizing society so they can maximize their profits, who need an ideological way of expressing those changes. And that brings them into conflict with the church, it brings them into conflict with wider society. And I think this is another factor that I'd add into the role of religion in it, because I do think that religion is ideological. It's how everyone in all of these revolts understood society. But I also think there was an economic aspect to it too. You had to pay tithes to the church. You had to, might rely on the local monastery for alms or help at particular times or shelter. And when those institutions attacked you or came under attack, as they did in the Reformation, then people revolted to defend them. Now, this allows people sometimes to say that these revolts were motivated by religion. And on one course, of course, that is true on one level. But on another, they were also revolts about community, about society, about how you understood the world. People felt their world was under attack and they wanted to defend it and protect it. And I think that's quite an interesting factor. If I can be indulgent, though, I just want to go back to the Peasants' Revolt, because there's a very interesting account by a monk at St. Albans, Walsingham, about one of our most important sources. And he gives what's probably a paraphrase of the John Ball speech. And John Ball uses the Bible, and it's magnificent, actually, the way he uses religion to articulate a very radical understanding of the world that people can understand. And he's supposed to have said at Blackheath in 1381, if God had intended there to be serfs and lords, surely they'd have been there at the beginning of the Bible, and they're not. There's Adam and Eve. And actually, that's very powerful. It's incredibly radical in the context of its times. And one of the things that we can't answer, and I'd love to know, is to what extent did that idea generalize through society? Did it really lead to a revolutionary challenge to the ideas of contemporary times?
I always look upon John Ball as the sort of Martin Luther King of his period. The articulation of political ideas, often through speeches which are deeply religious. And Martin Luther King had a similar speaking style, which he drew upon that sort of tradition. Just as an aside, though, the Pilgrimage of Grace was was actually, it was a reaction in many towns against the state seizing assets from their local churches that they'd built up as well, in terms of the way in which commissioners and others were sent to close, well, close individual churches as well as take control of the, well, the possessions that had been built up by the local community through dedication and contributions. Obviously, there was also a bit of payment of indulgences. Whoever thought up the payment of indulgences must actually, it was a brilliant fundraising scheme. Buying your way out of purgatory was just a wonderful invention to make the church rich. But the Pilgrimage of Grace actually was a reaction to that, wasn't it?
Very much so. And the trigger, the moment that the Pilgrimage of Grace and the earlier predecessing rebellion, the Lincolnshire Rebellion that took place just before it and can't really be separated, is the village of Louth in Lincolnshire, where people understood that the commissioners were coming to take away the silverware and the crosses and the bits of their church. And what's interesting, again, is you see the overlap between economics and religion here, because the church, it's a magnificent church. It's the tallest steeple of a parish church in England. It's very beautiful. But the people there had laboured to build that. They'd been part of donating to it. They'd worshipped there. They'd helped and, you know, be part of the creation of that church. And they felt it as being under attack. And so the Reformation was an attack on their religion, but it was also an attack on their community, and people revolted in with great violence and on a huge scale, and became a rebellion that really challenged the whole Reformation project of Henry VIII. I think if things had gone slightly differently, we could be living in a very, very different society today.
Final question. What were the lasting implications of these revolts?
Yeah, well, you know... The historian Rodney Hilton, who's really still, his history of 1381 is still my favorite go-to. He says, you know, the idea of the free man, or I would like to say free person, who owes deference to no one, you know, not even a social superior, who owes nothing to no one. That really comes out of the 14th century, really comes out of these revolts that are not just for freedom, but also for social equality. And, you know, I think that really does have its origin in the later Middle Ages. Another thing that I think really comes out of the late medieval period and the experience of these revolts is the power of corporate action. And that continues to be important to us today in trade unionism. I mean, trade unionism actually does have late medieval origins. So the fact that if people act as a group together, they can challenge even the most politically and socially elite members of society. That, I really think, does have its origins in these movements in this period.
And it's embedded within those society, those communities as well for
very much
long term. Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to underplay the extent to which the late medieval village community is a socially complex place. But there are communal bonds and a sense of egalitarianism and community that is very different from the hierarchical, stratified nature of the three orders that we were talking about earlier.
Martin, just to move on from that, this social solidarity that is an element or principle that seems to be emerging all the way through this, is that somehow translated into any form of, well, any legislative form, any basis in law where rights can be protected? Or how can that be consolidated? Or is it consolidated at this stage?
Well, I don't think in a direct way there was any consequences from these early revolts in terms of legislation or changes that have really fundamentally altered our lives today. I think Justin's right that what we get from these is a continuum of protest, a constant inspiration for people who come later for the past. What Tyler, Jack Straw, John Ball, Jack Cave become touchstones for everyone who comes after them. When they, in 1497, the Corinist rebels, an earlier revolt, march on London, one of their leaders says to them, we're going to go to Kent because Kent's never given in. Kent's the place where people will always resist. In fact, in this case, they didn't, and the consequences weren't great. But that sense that actually those figures are there and the past informs the present, I think, is very important. And that often took place quite quickly afterwards. But all of these rebellions were marked in the years following by small attempts at rebellion that often, you know, there would always be rumours that Jack Cade wasn't really dead or what Tyler had been seen and would come back. I also think later on, though, and I think Ted reflects this, mentions this about Winstanley and so on, the real sense of political ideas coming from this begin to inform a body of radical ideas later on, which help people have a different vision of how things can take place, both in the countryside and in general society. So people read and reread those speeches from John Ball and take new things for them, for their communities in more contemporary times. And that sense, actually, there's always been people who've talked about equality or freedom or justice or a world without rulers, a world without lords, matters more, I think, going forward than actually the particular actions in the sense of what took place in the different rebellions. It's not always positive. Joseph Arch, one of the founding trade union, agricultural trade unions in Britain, who was a Methodist, he right at the start tells the early trade unionists, I'm not a Wat Tyler. I'm a pacifist. I'm a reformist. I'm a religious man. I'm a Christian. We're not going to march on London and burning it down. So it's not a straightforward link. People draw from these historic revolts what they want to inspire and inform them for their contemporary ideas. But, you know, I think we can learn a lot and we can remain very inspired by the bravery of some of these men and women. As the others have said, the consequences many of these they faced for daring to speak out, to march, to protest was much, much more horrific. And you know, we owe them a debt for that, really.
You haven't fully read the Police and Crime Bill going through Parliament at the moment, have you?
Well, maybe we will need to learn. I'm going to stop that.
Yeah. Ted, sum up what you think came out of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Justin and Martin's comments. I think one interesting thing for me that I would draw out of what Justin said as well is that the involvement in these revolts of people who were actually not, if you like, the lowest of the low, but actually people who were involved in the running of their local communities is a really important thing to understand and be aware of. And I think it comes to this point that actually, the pre-modern state, the pre-modern English state is very diffused, and power at a local level is in the hands of, you know, some of these people, as we say, people like Kett, who actually end up being involved in leading these revolts, partly because they see it as part of their job of kind of maintaining and restoring good government. And I think there's maybe something to understand there in the way in which the practice of politics, so the practice pretty much of kind of self-government in a way, may then start to inform actual sort of political thinking about self-government and you know, the popular government almost. So I think we see most explicitly in those 1549 camps. And I think that then sort of feeds through into, you know, the ideas that we see emerging in the mid-17th century, with the levellers and the diggers, but also going on into the 18th century. For me, somebody like Thomas Paine is actually a really good example of somebody who also has this experience of working within this sort of local government of mainly unpaid officials, which I see is actually a key part of his political education in this sort of diffused pre-modern English state. There's another aspect to it, though, that I'd like to stress, which is the kind of the memory of the revolts themselves and the role that that plays. We get a lot of our kind of information about these revolts from chroniclers, most of whom are writing from a very hostile point of view. Their point is to say that revolts are terrible, that they're usually led by ambitious upstarts who are just in it for their own good because they, you know, greed, they want to become king themselves, and that the consequences are usually terrible for the people who get involved in them. So this is the kind of the moral of the story most of the time. But actually, I think even when we're looking at the period when these chronicles are being written, there are alternative narratives that are being produced. There are the kinds of things that people like Andy Wood have uncovered around the 1549 rebellions, where people are actually talking about this is a very positive time, as the time, the camping time, as Martin said, where people were eating roast meats and kind of enjoying good government under Robert Kett. And then we've got even, you know, playwrights like Shakespeare, who on one level, you know, in his Henry VI seems to be kind of rehearsing the same sort of story about, you know, an upstart rebel captain in Jack Cade. But at the other time seems to be articulating things that sound very much like John Ball. So in the interchange where Cade is saying, I'm going to make myself king, and somebody else says, but you're the son of a shearman. And then he says, yes, but Adam was a gardener. So, you know, there's this, we go back to this point about fundamental equality being rehearsed on stage. And so even though I think the memory in terms of, you know, certainly in terms of printed works over the 17th and 18th century tends to be very hostile, and it's a morality story about popular revolt leading to chaos, disorder, and then, you know, fierce reprisals, it creates this store of memory and stories for others who view these things in a different way. And certainly by the time we get to the 19th century, we've got much more positive invocations of Cade and of Tyler by groups like the Chartists, by early socialist and Marxist movements, who see it as very attractive because it gives them a kind of native revolutionary tradition that they can fix upon. They don't have to say, oh, we're, you know, Frenchified, you know, revolutionaries. Actually, we're acting in this good, solid English tradition of insurrection. And that thing is actually really interesting to me because we then enter, I think, the most recent invocations of Tyler are in our whole debate about Englishness and what it means. I mean, Paul Kingsnorth, the writer, was calling for a Wat Tyler Day instead of St. George's Day. You know, what does it mean to be English? Does it mean, you know, to be loyal to the Queen, to, you know, be Church of England, fly the St. George's flag? Does it mean something else? Does it mean, you know, to have this tradition of equality, of defending rights, of defending, you know, the rights of ordinary people? So I think it's become part of a much wider debate about who we are as a nation.
It's interesting the number of local celebrations that are taking place. Unfortunately, COVID has prevented some over the last year. But for example, the Diggers Festival in Wigan has now been organised again for September. Those sort of localised celebrations of working class struggle are actually providing a depiction, exactly as you said, really, of what Englishness was all about at that time. My own view from this, and I'm trying not to be too romantic about it because the scale of human suffering that took place was immense. But for me, the lesson from it all is the burgeoning working class confidence that they can change the world and that they can change their lives. And that's what comes from this, from all of me. Setting up camps as bases for revolt was a strategy used in the late medieval period. Camps have been used by modern-day protesters, Climate Camp and Occupy. And I asked Joe Ryle, a participant in both Climate Camp and Occupy, why a camp was important.
So the Camp for Climate Actions were a really pivotal space that was created for bringing activists and those concerned about climate change together in one place to organise actions. You know, I remember being at the Climate Camp in Blackheath in 2009, which actually was on the site of the Peasants' Revolt in 1381. And it was chosen to be that site because, you know, that was where the peasants had arrived to set about attacking political targets in the city at that point. And in 2009, we could see the city of London in the backdrop, which was the cause of a lot of these emissions and climate change. And it would, you know, there were incredible spaces that were created with all manner of different people coming from descending into these camps from all across the country. And you'd have these really creative sessions and workshops so people could get involved and go off and take actions together. There was the year 2009, I remember, there was an action outside the Royal Bank of Scotland where bunch of people just got together, decided they wanted to go and target it, and everyone went and super glued themselves to the front doors of RBS that morning, which created huge media coverage. So they're a really important space for bringing people together in the same way that Occupy London was, and the, you know, the tension that grabbed when they were camped outside the stairs of St. Paul's Cathedral.
And it achieved publicity.
Yeah,
solidarity.
Yeah, there was, I mean, huge publicity. The first ever climate camp I think you actually came along to, John, yourself, was the one at Heathrow Airport. You know, and the site was chosen quite effectively because it was actually on the proposed land that they wanted to build the third runway. And so we occupied the site and created a very alternative, different way of living to highlight in the face of this huge new, you know, huge emitting runway they wanted to build. It was a very bad idea. And I think you'll remember the press coverage was immense. It was kind of the top story in the country every day of that week, partly down to some of the overhand policing, I must say.
It created such an atmosphere of solidarity, but also it was an educational experience where people sat around talking about the issues that we were confronting, both the local threat of the third runway, but also climate change. So it became an educational experience too for so many people.
Yeah, it's educational, but both for the activists involved and also for the local residents, because you'll know yourself that the third runway threatened thousands of homes in the area. And what it meant was this amazing amalgamation of local residents and activists from around the country, where by the end of that camp, the activists better understood the kind of local impact and the kind of the impact it was having on local communities from having their homes destroyed, having that as a threat hanging over them. And also on the other side, the local residents then understood the wider implications in terms of the climate and the emissions it would cause. So it was really educational. And, you know, I think we've missed since the climate camps ended, I think there has, you know, we've missed those spaces that gives the opportunity for bringing people together. And hopefully the world transformed now, the Momentum event is doing a bit of that. But yeah, they're an amazing amazing movement to be a part of.
Thanks, Joe. I'll see you at the next revolt, the next camp.
Great.
In virtually every generation, working class people have risen up in some form to improve their lives and secure basic rights and change the world in which they live. We should remember, celebrate, but also importantly, learn from this. I hope you've enjoyed this session of the podcast. Our next session will be looking at the English Civil War. Join me then, because this was an important period in which many of the ideals of the society that working people wanted to create were discussed, debated, and actually fought for.